KPPPLP, Fargo-Moorhead, 88.1 FM. This is Nemo Cicados, and I hope we're finding you and finding me at KPPPLP Fargo-Moorhead, 88.1 FM, where we are adding local queer color to your airwaves. Tune in to listen at 5 p.m. on the first Wednesday of the month for new content on the radio at 88.1 FM on your dial and at our website at kppfm.com and click to listen to the podcast player. We have live stream Facebook etiquette. Please refer to KPPPLP Fargo-Moorhead's Facebook comment rules. Links will be dropped down in the comments. Be a good audience. Don't harass the host, technician, moderator, other audience members, or the moderator will enforce the rules and ban you. Links will be dropped into the comments, like I said, and you can open a new tab in your browser or take a look at it later so you can avoid getting banned. If you want to comment on the show or have an interview arranged with me, you can contact us at 701-566-0917. At Nemo Potatoes on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Contact me at kppfm.com/find-me. Hit the contact tab right over here, and then you can email me at nemo@kppfm.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at KPPP Radio, at People's Press Project, at Mexican Online. So that's our radio station, 88.1 FM Fargo-Moorhead, the People's Press Project, and Mexi-Can. Donations to Fargo-Moorhead's low-power commercial-free radio station can be made at our website at kppfm.com/donate and check out our underwriting opportunities at kppfm.com/underwriting-opportunities on how you can support the first queer radio program in the Red River Valley. So last month, we talked about what new parents of LGBT and queer youth can do to show what ways they can support their children when they come out and your child's transition to being out. In this month's program, I'd like to introduce you to my special guest, writer for The Queer Black Millennial, editor-in-chief, Deshaun Harrison. He is a 21-year-old student at Morehouse College studying sociology. Harrison is an abolitionist, organizer, and operates with Black Queer Feminist Politic. He is an avid reader, a writer, music enthusiast, a Twitter connoisseur, and chronic Netflix binge watcher. So here he is.
Hello.
Hello, Deshaun. So I am interviewing you today. We're going to start with an icebreaker. I mean, I gave your bio a little bit, but if you'd like, go ahead and tell more about yourself for our audience.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, I'm a 21-year-old student at Morehouse College. I study sociology and African-American studies on the pre-law track. I serve as the editor-in-chief of Queer Black Millennial, which is a newly founded queer trans publication designed specifically for Black folk, for us to share our own narratives, to have our own stories that oftentimes are left out of media. So it's a digital publication specifically for Black, queer, and trans people, youth specifically. And I am a socialist. I'm an organizer. I am a writer. I'm a lot of different things, but that's like the gist of who I am.
Awesome. So in this program, I wanted to ask you, and I've been meaning to do it for a while, but it was just a matter of the opportunity. And I think it's great that I'm talking about it with you, which is the queer community's relationship with police, you know, the history, and because at least white queer folks have trouble combating this, especially understanding that dynamic.
Right.
So I want to start off with the question, what are your thoughts on police?
That's a good question. So I don't like the police. I am fully for the abolition of the police force. And I think that when I say that, a lot of times people look at it as like a radical stance to have. But if you look at the history of policing, especially in America, police were specifically created to catch slaves, right? So like the entire premise behind the police force is anti-black in nature. And so when people talk about like abolishing the police, or when they talk about getting rid of the police force, it really is, it's almost like it is a necessary stance to have if you are at all for black lives or queer lives or any marginalized life, because black people operate in all those spaces. And police have never been for the advancement of black or brown people. So, my thoughts on the police are that the force must be abolished, and that there is no other way around that. Like it is a necessary part of liberation.
Wholly agree. And when you think about that, you have to like consider that system and, you know, how it started. You mentioned that, you know, it started as like, you know, catching slaves, and
right.
I read about that. And it's obvious when you look at evidence, for example, of like police badges, the star, probably pull up those photos when I edit this video later, but the evidence is everywhere. It started off as a slave catching system, and it's always
right.
enforcing the laws of the privileged. So,
right.
And what do you also think about the individuals who try to work within that system and policing our communities?
So I think that reform is a necessary step to an end, right? So like people oftentimes talk about police reform and criminal reform, and I think that that's a necessary part, but a lot of those same folks think that that is the end goal, and it's not the end goal. The end goal is, like I mentioned, is abolition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that as far as working within the system, I don't think that there's no justification for anyone who works as a police officer, especially if they claim to be for black lives or if they claim to care about marginalized people, because again, like the police force was designed to protect capital and to protect money and to protect the rich and not to protect poor folks, which has disproportionately been black folks in America. So I think that there is a responsibility for people who care about marginalized people, who care about black lives, to not work within the police force. But I also think that it's a responsibility for those of us who do identify as socialist or communist or any political social stance on the left. It's important for us to create alternatives for people to work and to find money in ways that don't force them to exist in these very brutal, very violent spaces like the police.
Yeah, I'm nodding over here like, yeah, okay. Yes, yeah. Yeah. So, and then like, I was reading a bunch of like Tumblr posts because it's for some reason, it's really hard to find, like on the Google, at least, the historical evidence of the way police have enforced laws upon queer people. And there was at least one Tumblr post, and I'm kind of like going to summarize it right now and then read it in full later in the next part of this program after our call, but you can see it later. Summarizing the fact that it's always, you know, Stonewall started, you know, by black trans women and black trans people, trans women of color in general, and that police would entrap queer people in such a way that, you know, they would be arrested, harassed endlessly, and, you know, Stonewall was that breaking point, and it wasn't about, like, whether or not we were getting married or not, it was just about the end of that harassment.
Right. Absolutely.
So I suppose I kind of wanted to ask about your feelings about that and, you know, trying to make that distinction for people, especially queer people.
Yeah. So actually, this is funny that you mentioned that, because I was just having a conversation / argument / debate, whatever you want to call it, on Twitter yesterday with a white gay man who posted a link to Azealia Banks doing a cover of something at a gay pride.
Uh-huh.
And the caption said, like, Azealia Banks did more for the gay community than the person who threw the first stone during Stonewall. And it was meant to be a joke, right? But like the work of Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera specifically has been erased so violently for so long that joke didn't register as funny to me at all. It really felt very disrespectful. And so like I was kind of giving like a brief history lesson on the Stonewall uprisings. And so, yeah, police played an active role in Marsha's and Sylvia's, like, response that night, which is often, it's often taught that, like, Stonewall riots were just or uprisings is what I want to call it, which is like a one-night thing, but it happened over the course of weeks, months, where people were sick of being targeted and violently, like, abused by police. And so Marsha and Sylvia threw those first stones and those first bottles at Stonewall. And I think that speaks to, like, a much larger point in American history, at least, with Black and brown folks having to respond in a way that would be labeled as aggressive or as violent in order for people to even, like, listen to us in any instance at all, right? So, like, when it comes to police and their involvement in that, police have been harassing Black, queer, trans folks for a long time prior to that. Like you mentioned, like, it had been a long, violent history of them harassing Black trans women and brown trans women for a long time before that. And Marsha and Sylvia just went to get drinks, to have fun, to be amongst community, and ended up having to become, like, almost like martyrs for the movement. And we're still erased, and we're still, like, targeted and harassed, not only by police, but also by white gay men and white lesbian women, mm-hmm. both of whom were cis people. And so I think that when I talk about, like, the importance of abolishing the police to non-Black and non-brown people, to white folks who are gay and lesbian and are cis, it becomes talking to them about that, which I don't often do anymore because I mm-hmm. found that it's largely a waste of time on my end.
Right.
But
you got better things to do.
Yeah, like, but talking to them about that is important for other white folks who get it to do, because most times when talking to them about their privilege and talking to them about the police force, like, the two go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes, like, again, the history, like, shows that police were able to target Marsha and they were able to target Sylvia and other folks like them because of the fact that white gay men and white lesbian women allowed them to do so. They didn't create space for Black trans women and brown trans women to exist in these spaces, right? And, like, there was a movement pushing for marriage and was pushing for, like, to be recognized as people who could get married in the States. And that's cute and dandy, but, like, trans women are still being murdered. And, like,
right.
Black queer folks are still committing suicide and still being harassed by family and stuff like that. And so, like, to me, we can't talk about, like, abolishing police without talking about white gay men and white lesbian women's complicity in allowing police to harass us.
Right, so, as they hold on to their white supremacy.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's see. I remember this being, like, blowing up in the last, what was it, 2 years ago maybe, where, like, you know, thoughts on police and pride functions or interacting with the queer community even today, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. what do you think of that?
I think that's another instance. I think it's just another, like, example of exactly what Marsha and Sylvia were fighting against. Those were the first pride moments, and police were harassing folks. And so I think, again, like, pride has, I actually wrote about this as well. Mm-hmm. Pride has become just a place for rainbow capitalism to exist mm-hmm. rapidly and without interruption. And what I mean by rainbow capitalism is that it gives room for companies and businesses who have their hands in the slave work of Black and brown people and have their hands in the deaths of Black, queer, and brown people around the world. But they're presenting this festival that's supposed to be, like, forward thinking and for all queer rights and stuff like that. But their investment is really just in the money, and it really is just in business and finance. And so the police presence being there is just another example of that to me that says, hey, we're really here to protect capital. We're really here to make sure that people don't get too out of hand. And by people, I mean folks who are not cis, who are not white, who are not men, to not get too out of hand, right? And, like, make sure that we're protecting these businesses that are giving their time away to be here. But it also is an example of white gay men and white lesbian women and their organizations like HRC, right? who are really more invested in, like, in, they're more invested in capital. They're more invested in business. They're more invested in
their donors, their supporters.
Exactly. And their supporters in their following and their platform than they are in protecting trans women and Black and brown queer folk, right? Because if that wasn't the case, there would be no police presence at Pride. Mm-hmm. If that wasn't the case, a lot of businesses who exist at Pride wouldn't be there, like Jack Daniels and Walmart mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. These businesses who are invested in slave trade and prison mm-hmm. labor and stuff like that. And so it just, I do not go to any, like, white Pride events. If I go to Pride, it's here in Atlanta during, like, Black Pride, when there's nothing but Black and brown people all around everywhere and we're enjoying each other's space. Because white Pride, and I don't mean, like, white pride is in like the historical thing, but like white pride events are white pride. Like,
yeah.
And they're really capitalistic and they're really like invested in protecting whiteness. And yeah, so I think that's just another like really clear example of white privilege going hand in hand with the police force and upholding white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about that a lot because at least in this community, it's been very, very white. Even though Native Americans have been here for eons and eons
right.
before colonization, they've had gender diversity and experience in the identity right. of like third gender and two-spirit. But mm-hmm. like up at least up here where I am in Fargo Moorhead, you know, it's very white and, you know, I'm like low-key jealous because like, you know, the closest like, you know, black and brown queer experience is in Minneapolis for me, but I can't mm-hmm. go that far all the time. And it's only, yep. like, you know, once in a blue moon when, like, you know, the station is out to go to meetings to improve our work. So,
right.
you know, because I look at the, you know, the white pride queerness that's over here. I'm just kind of like,
No, I relate really heavily to that. Like, before I moved to Atlanta, I lived in a big town, small city back in North Carolina. And there was no black pride. There was no, like, huge black and brown space where just black, queer, and trans people got to exist together. So I completely understand that. Atlanta is a really unique place in that regard.
Yeah, because, like, you know, on top of that, at least up here, there seems to be, like, a weird... a lot of the black and brown folks are here are, like, really colonized, heavily colonized, because, mm-hmm. you know, the way they were raised and their oh, relatives right. before them and so on. And so right. it's just, like, really hard for me, someone who's trying to... go through a decolonization process and then watch these other people continue doing their thing. It's like, hey, you don't have to live like that anymore. You don't.
Right. You really don't. But it's also unfortunately really understandable because socialization is a really, really powerful thing that has affected a lot of us, especially like colonized people. And it is a struggle to break away from. So like, I try to be a little bit easier on black and brown folk than I am on white people who just won't get it because white people don't deserve that leeway in my mind. But black and brown folk have been through a lot, so I'm a little more lenient.
Oh, yeah. Both. Oh, yeah, of course. I'm more lenient, and, you know, it's why I have my program the way it is. Like, you know,
right.
like, yes, it's a queer show, but I make it intersectional as possible. I remind white queer women what they need to do to help support... queer women of color or other queer people of color. And right. I had a program back in February where there's been a lot of talk in the past year or two about whether or not queer was a slur. And I had to like do a lot of digging about, well, yes, it was, but it was reclaimed in right. a very specific manner to, you know, completely say F you to all the things that is supremacy in all its forms.
Right. Exactly. So, absolutely.
Yeah, and so I was exploring that, and I decided to help some people and inform them, okay, this is what queer really is about. It's, you know, right. it's being against capitalism. It's being against the heteropatriarchy. It's being against, yep. like, everything. Like
it's
everything,
normativity.
Right. It's everything that's normal to you, the opposite of that is queer. And
it's queer.
And that's what I often prescribe to, because I am anything but normal. And I'm right. And I'm 100% okay with that. So, right. you know, why would I pretend to be any different?
Right. Yeah, no, I talk about that a lot, especially in my writing, because I exist as this person with so many marginalized intersections, like being black and being queer and being non-binary and being disabled and being poor, right? And so, like, it wasn't until I understood myself as queer that I was able to actually get the lingo or, like, the language to really talk about what it looks like and what it means to exist with these on these different margins. And how all of that is queerness, and how, you know, like me living with a mental health condition or several mental health conditions with while being black and while being queer, like totally looks totally different than what it would look like for a white man who's Christian or something like that. So I definitely get that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now let's see, to this last question I've got here. So like, mm-hmm. What do you think white queer folks could do to actually make queer people of color feel safer?
Oh.
I mean, if you could, like, you know, if there were anyone that was, like, legitimately listening, wanting to actually be a proper ally to the queer folks in their community who happen mm-hmm. to be people of color, what should they do?
If if that one person exists, I guess what I would say to them is one, to, as difficult as it is to have those really hard conversations with their family and with their community, or their communities, they're necessary. It's difficult for them, but it's a whole lot harder for us. And so sitting around and having like the really tough conversations with your families and with your communities is the number one thing in my mind that I think white queer folks specifically can do to be for the advancement of black queer and trans people, brown queer and trans people. And that looks like talking about police abolition. It looks like talking about like ridding ourselves of cis heteronormativity and cis homonormativity. It looks like talking about ridding ourselves of capitalism. It looks like talking about anti-blackness within your homes and within your communities and different things like that. Like having those really tough conversations that would otherwise not be had or would not be listened to is important for what I would call like my white comrades. I also think that, you know, it's important to not expect so much labor on the behalf of, or from rather, black and brown, queer and trans folk. Like the reality is that a lot of us are going to have to, we have to explain our realities and our lives and stuff to people all the time. And it's a part of living as we do. And if we don't explain it, who will, right? But like, if you come from a place of privilege that allows you space to do so, you should be compensating people for that in some way. Even if it's not like monetarily, if you're able to like take them out to lunch or boost their work or their social media or whatever it may be, like doing something to make sure that the relationship is not one-sided. I think that, you know, investing more time in learning about our oppression and our like marginalizations, like reading the text that you wouldn't otherwise read, right? So maybe instead of reading Gloria, you read bell hooks. Instead of reading like other like major white feminists or theologians or theorists, you read black ones. You read Fanon. You read Angela Davis. You read like Kwame Ture. You read these black theorists, these black feminists, these black queer folk, these black folk, and these brown folk who existed on margins before and who exist on margins now, that can give you better insight to our experiences than any white author or artist could. But also just listening to the people around you who are not white, who are not cis, who are not straight, who are not, you know, non-disabled, who are not Christian, just being mindful of other experiences and listening to those people that are around you that are telling you like, hey, this is killing me, or hey, this is pushing me aside, or hey, this is causing me to experience homelessness or whatever it may be. Just being mindful of all of that. And I think the list really could go on and on and on, but I think that those are really like productive starts to lead to a much greater experience for everyone involved.
Wow. Yeah. 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 I suppose the follow-up question, like, you know, because you listed some mm-hmm. names, like, you know, do you have any specific titles you would recommend for people to dig into?
For books?
Yeah, so, sure.
So I have read like a lot of books, and so I'm going to just try to throw some out there. So
sure.
I think that, well, this book was written by a white man, a French man, but it's a really great book. So History of Sexuality by Michel Foucault is a really beautiful book that I think everyone should read. It talks about the history of sexuality, heterosexuality, homosexuality, the spectrum that is sexuality, and just all of that. It's really important, I think. So reading that book would be helpful. But beyond that, I think like reading anything by Fanon is important. Reading, oh my God, I have so many books in mind. Like reading almost like honestly, reading anything by Angela Davis, reading anything by Chimamanda Adichie, reading anything by Kwame Ture, and just so many different authors and artists that I'm like losing in my head right now. there's like a lot of black, specifically black queer socialist, feminist writers who have written like extensively on all this stuff, and all these theories and all of these topics. Of course, you can't get away from Marx and Lenin, and Stalin and all of them. They're very important as well, but they've influenced the work of people who have introduced like really intersectional writings like Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term intersectionality, and like Alice Walker. And I'm just naming like so many people now. There's so many brilliant writers out there. So just finding those folks and finding whatever like excites you the mm-hmm. most and reading them. Judith Butler, who just all these brilliant people who even like may not be black, but have brought like really interesting and important perspectives to the discourse, TM, and to like understanding theory and understanding like these different margins and stuff like that.
All right, thank you. I'll probably put some links in the comments to like maybe some books they can like purchase or something. And if you want, you can send them to me yourself if that it's okay. helpful, and I can like give that to our audience.
Okay, yeah, I can definitely do that. I have a bunch of books like that I just can't think of the name of right now, but I like that they're sitting in my book bag, so I'll make sure I do that.
Then we can do that. So I think that's all the questions I have for you, and including the follow-up, because I actually was interested in reading the books. I'm a big book reader myself, always have been, and so I'll probably actually look at that myself as well.
Okay.
Let's see. Do you have any like last words for our audience or knowledge to impart upon us, you know?
I don't know. I guess just to, I think I kind of gave everything. I don't know. I think if anything I'm going to give is really going to be...
full, uncensored, like, you know, say what you like.
Okay. Yeah, I guess like just to anyone who's listening, like follow folks on social media who are engaged in this work and who are doing the writing, who are doing the organizing, who are doing the educating and the speaking and stuff like that, who oftentimes are unheard and not noticed. I myself, like I own my own business. My business is called Deshaun L. Harrison, and through that I write for people. So I recognize that like my writing is something that I enjoy and it makes me money. And so like looking, maybe if you're looking for someone to edit something for you or to like to write something for you, instead of going to like a bigger company who already has the money, go and support like an indie artist instead. Just doing different things that could benefit someone that would otherwise not be benefiting or would not benefit from your resources or from your access. So that's pretty much it.
All right, cool. Thank you. You can reach Deshaun Harrison, Editor-in-Chief of the Queer Black Millennial, at info@deshaunharrison.com. You can check out his content on Facebook and on Instagram at TheGodlySean and on Twitter at _IAmRoyal. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So on to this next thing here. I have this study by the Williams Institute, Discrimination and Harassment by Law Enforcement Officers in the LGBT Community. I wanted to read the first couple of pages from this study that was done way back in 2015. Let's see. Done by Christy Mallory, Amira Hassenbush, and Brad Sears. Take this with a grain of salt because it was done in 2015, 3 years old, and consider some current event knowledge with what you've seen and known about police. And the executive summary is as follows. Discrimination and harassment by law enforcement based on sexual orientation and gender identity is an ongoing and pervasive problem in LGBT communities. Such discrimination impedes effective policing in these communities by breaking down trust, inhibiting communication, and preventing officers from effectively protecting and serving the communities they police. While a patchwork of state, local, and federal laws provide some protection against certain forms of discrimination, there is no nationwide federal statute that comprehensively and consistently prohibits discrimination based on actual or perceived sexual orientation and gender identity. This report presents research demonstrating that LGBT individuals and communities face profiling, discrimination, and harassment at the hands of law enforcement officers. Data from a wide range of sources show that such harassment and discrimination is greatest for LGBT people of color, transgender persons, and youth. So I'm going to give you a bit of a summary, or at least as close a summary as I can, to get through this, because I have a little bit more material to go through, and a couple of your comments. Let's see. If you need to, you can take a look at this document yourself. I'll be dropping it down in the comments so that you can read it. It's a 28-page study. I'm only going to read like the first two pages or so, but you know, break it down because it's a little bit hard to consume otherwise. So the key findings includes 9.5 million LGBT Americans are part of every local and state community and part of diverse communities that law enforcement seeks to engage to develop stronger communities support and trust. The U.S. has had a significant history of mistreatment of LGBT people by law enforcement, including profiling, entrapment, discrimination, and harassment by officers. victimization that often was ignored by law enforcement, and discrimination, even blanket exclusions from being hired by law enforcement agencies. The Department of Justice recently summarized this history of discrimination against LGBT people in its brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in Windsor versus United States. Discrimination and harassment by law enforcement officers based on sexual orientation and gender identity continues to be pervasive throughout the U.S. A 2014 report on National Survey of LGBT People and People Living with HIV found that 73% of respondents had face-to-face contact with the police in the past 5 years. Of those respondents, 21% reported encountering hostile attitudes from officers, 14% reported verbal assault by the police, 3% reported sexual harassment, and 2% reported physical assault at the hands of law enforcement officers. Police abuse, neglect, and misconduct were consistently reported at higher frequencies by respondents of color and transgender and gender nonconforming respondents. A 2013 report focused on anti-LGBT violence that occurred in the previous year found that of the LGBT violence survivors surveyed who had interacted with police, 48% reported that they had experienced police misconduct, including unjustified arrest, use of excessive force, and entrapment. Additionally, police officers accounted for 6% of all offenders reported by respondents. Of offenders who were personally unknown to the victim, police made up 23%. A 2012 report examining the interactions of law enforcement with Latina transgender women in Los Angeles County found that 2/3 of the women reported that they had been verbally harassed by law enforcement. 21% reported that they had been physically assaulted by law enforcement. 24% reported that they had been sexually assaulted by law enforcement. A 2011 study that reported findings from the largest survey of transgender people to date found that 22% of transgender respondents reported that they had been harassed by law enforcement because of bias, and 6% reported having been physically assaulted by an officer. Additionally, nearly half of respondents, 46%, reported being uncomfortable seeking police assistance. Individual complaints of discrimination also document examples of police misconduct against LGBT people. These reports include instances of verbal harassment, physical abuse, so were that it required medical attention, and rape. Such discrimination, harassment, and abuse undermine effective policing by, and I'm summarizing this, weakening community trust, reducing report of crimes by victims in the LGBT community, challenging law enforcement's ability to effectively meet the needs of members of their communities. Reducing reporting of crimes and the victims. Yeah, okay. And you can read these statistics of those points in the report near the bottom of page 2, which then goes into key recommendations, although as we've already covered in the earlier interview with Harrison, I would rather we do away with policing as a system and police our own communities and teach each other how to protect ourselves and each other. Now, audience, you may be asking, why are you against police at prides or interacting with community? Some of it was voiced by Harrison himself. Some of it I interjected in the interview. But one, you have to understand the origins of police in the United States. You have to understand the purpose of police. And you have to understand what they've done to queer folks, including queer people of color, which is talked about in the Williams Institute. And the safety and lives of queer people of color are greater than the feelings of queer whites, which perpetuates white supremacy. When you understand points 1 and 2, everything else will fall into place. I'll be dropping more articles that I read of people complaining, police apologists, as well as generally people being tone deaf to these issues. For example, we have this fun article by Odyssey Online, written by Tiffany Baruti. It was written back in, 2016, so 2 years ago-ish. And it kind of gives context to, like, the raids. So, like, in 1969, the NYPD raided the Stonewall Inn. Raids on gay bars were not uncommon at the time, but what made the raid on Stonewall unique was the patrons of the bar fought back. The resulting riots, led by trans people of color, challenged police oppression of the queer community and is widely credited as the event that sparked the modern queer liberation struggle. Now, 47 years later, the story has changed. Instead of resisting the police, the mainstream LGBTQ movement embraces them. At New York's annual Pride Parade, the NYPD was given the opportunity to march in uniform and was even cheered on by a crowd of mostly white queer people. And New York is not alone. All across the U.S. and Canada, police departments are given the opportunity to march in uniform in Pride parades. Several organizations advocating for queer people of color have protested this arrangement. Most recently, the Toronto chapter of Black Lives Matter managed to interrupt Toronto's Pride Parade. They demanded that police floats be removed from Pride. Pride organizers initially agreed to the terms, but then backed down. This has triggered a lot of reactionary racism amongst white queer people. What a lot of us white queer people simply don't get is that our whiteness shields us from many of the realities of police brutality. And that's Tiffany speaking as, you know, the writer. The response I heard from a lot of white queers was, quote, "The police protect us, so we shouldn't alienate them." What we don't get is that while the police may protect us, people of color are not given the same treatment. Not all cops are bad, but the police as an institution are extremely oppressive. This has been the case since the creation of police as we know them today. Before the mid-19th century, communities generally organized their own police forces. This changed when the rising upper class needed a way to keep, quote, social order, so that the capitalist system would be maintained, or a supremacist system. Thus, a centralized bureaucratic police force was founded. This new police force was primarily used to crush strikes and other labor-related uprisings, or slave uprisings. Police oppression has always been specifically targeted to people of color. Boom! Black people especially. In the South, the first modern police force was the Slave Patrol. The Slave Patrols had three primary responsibilities: to catch escaped slaves, to terrorize slaves, to deter slave revolts, what'd I just say, and to punish any slave who did escape. As the 19th century went on, the Slave Patrols did not go away, even after Civil War. In fact, many Slave Patrols went on to form organizational structure of most Southern police forces. Huh. And, of course, police oppression of black bodies continues to this day. We constantly see people like Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Laquan McDonald, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, and so many others who are murdered for the simple crime of being black in the United States. Last year, a study by the Washington Post found that even though black men only make up 6% of the population, they account for 40% of unarmed victims of police shootings. The Toronto Police Department specifically has a long and disturbing history of racism. So, like I said, and as that proved by a white person speaking and talking to other white people, especially queer people, it's bad. And if you want to know how people complain about the Toronto Police Department or whatever, or at least the Twin Cities, I know that was big. So, like, I pulled this article written by Karen Zamora at the Star Tribune, written June 22nd, 2017. So this is more recent. And I figured since I'm publishing this this show in May, might as well let the show air the month before Pride Month hits, right? Yeah. So she writes, Twin Cities Pride organizers are asking police officers not to march in the big Minneapolis parade on Sunday in light of the Philando Castile case and continued tension between officers and marginalized communities. After St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez was acquitted Friday in the shooting death of Castile, many who planned to attend the parade voiced their concerns about a police presence, organizers said. Minneapolis Police Chief Janet Hartaux, who broke barriers as the first lesbian to lead the department, called the decision divisive in a letter to parade organizers Thursday. Quote, "I am beyond disappointed that you didn't feel you could talk to with me before making such a divisive decision that has really hurt so many in our community, including the LGBT members of this department and their family members." Later, she replied to someone on Twitter who told her not to attend. "Sad you believe I have spent my life protecting people from harm and discrimination. You? I have done so much for you." I've heard that before. The annual parade, which draws 350,000 people, has started in previous years with several marked squad cars and uniformed police officers heading down Hennepin Avenue in downtown Minneapolis. This year, organizers said, there will only be one unmarked police car, mandated for safety reasons, at the front of the parade. There will be, quote, "limited police participation in the parade itself." Twin Cities Pride said in a statement, "There will be fewer police officers in uniform compared to last year, when Minneapolis police upped their patrol after a shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando," organizers said. We always have several police departments wanting to roll down Hennepin with lights and sirens to participate in this announcement that the parade is about to begin," organizers said in a statement. With the recent verdict in Philando Castile's case, Twin Cities Pride has decided to forgo this part of the police participation in the parade for this year and respect the pain the community is feeling right now. While many regular parade attendees applaud the change, those in uniform criticized it as exclusionary. St. Paul Deputy Police Chief Mary Nash said she was disappointed in that her colleagues have shared their frustration. Nash, the department's LGBTQ liaison, said 12 to 25 St. Paul police officers have taken part in the parade in previous years. Quote, "I understand people are angry and we can respect their feelings. But the reality is, at the end of the day, if we can't work together, it becomes more challenging to become better as a community and to become better as a police department." Well, I don't know. You could maybe, like, talk to queer people as, like, you know, fellow people instead of, like, potential arrests. That'd be nice. Lieutenant Bob Kroll, president of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, said organizers should be ashamed and called the action disturbing. "It's shameful to see this group of leadership head in this direction," Kroll said in a statement. "With the uptick in terrorist attacks worldwide, this outward anti-police sentiment is alarming. For an organization that prides itself on being accepting and inclusive, the hypocrisy amazes me." Look in the mirror, my friend. Look in the mirror. Twin Cities Pride Parade chairwoman Darcy Bauman said the organization did not intend to hurt or harm anyone, making anyone feel excluded. "Unfortunately, we have hurt and offended the LGBTQ officers, and that was not our intent," Bauman said. "But in the wake of the verdict, we want to be sensitive to the population that is grieving, and seeing those uniforms bring angst and tension in the feeling of unrest." Across the country, other Pride events are taking similar actions. Organizers in Portland, Oregon, are asking officers to consider not wearing their uniforms because some don't feel comfortable attending alongside police in uniform, according to the Oregonian. Various law enforcement officials were upset, and at least one county sheriff's department decided to not march at all. In the Twin Cities, Ava Wood, anti-violence program director at the LGBTQ rights group Out Front, said she supports the organizers' decision. Quote, "I personally think they made the right call," Wood said. The increased police presence in response to the Orlando shooting at Pride last year left many people of color feeling unsafe, Wood said. Quote, "Specifically, the queer and trans people of color reached out to us saying cops in uniform at Pride might make white people feel safe, but not us." And then at the end of that article, which I will be linking down at the bottom, they attached a letter to Dot Bessler, executive director of Twin Cities Pride, and written by Janae L. Harteau, with their complaint and about excluding police officers. But at the end of the day, cops are cops, and it's not a sexual orientation. It's just a job. You take off your uniform at the end of the day, but you're still always queer, and you're still a person of color, and you're still white at the end of the day. But we can't stop being queer or people of color. And if you already see us as enemies, then you should probably get out of Pride. You seem to misunderstand the whole concept of sexual orientation and gender identity. So, let's see. What else do I got here for you folks? Here we go. The History of Policing in the United States. I will also drop that into the comments for you to look at. You can also do your own Googling, and there's plenty of YouTube videos you can find. But here is the History of Policing in the United States, Part 1, which implies that it is more than one part. It's a big history. And I'm going to skip to this little snippet here. Let's see. Yeah, which is basically what I said earlier. It's like in the, 5th paragraph here, small paragraph. The modern police organizations shared similar characteristics. 1, they were publicly supported and bureaucratic in form. Police officers were full-time employees, not community volunteers or case-by-case. Here we go. Actually, sixth paragraph. In the southern states, the development of American policing followed a different path. The genesis of modern police organizations in the South is the Slave Patrol. Platt, 1982. The first formal slave patrol was created in Carolina colonies in 1704. Reichel, 1992. Slave patrols had three primary functions. One, to chase down, apprehend, and return their owners, runaway slaves. Two, to provide a form of organized terror to deter slave revolts, and three, to maintain a form of discipline for slave workers who are subject to summary justice outside of the law if they violate any plantation rules. Following the Civil War, these vigilante-style organizations evolved in the modern southern police departments primarily as a means of controlling freed slaves who are now laborers working in agricultural caste system and forcing Jim Crow segregation laws designed to deny freed slaves equal rights and access to the political system. And then, it's not haha like funny, but like haha, this is effing terrible, fudging terrible. The key question, of course, is what was it about the United States in the 1830s that necessitated the development of local, centralized, bureaucratic police forces? One answer is that cities were growing. The United States was no longer a collection of small cities and rural hamlets. The urbanization was occurring at ever-quickening pace. An old, informal watch and constable system was no longer adequate to control disorder. Anecdotal accounts suggest increasing crime and vice in urban centers, mob violence, particularly violence directed at immigrants and African Americans by white youths, occurred with some frequency. Public disorder, mostly public drunkenness and sometimes prostitution, was more visible and less easily controlled in growing urban centers than it had been in rural villages. But evidence of an actual crime wave is lacking. So if the modern American police force was not a direct response to crime, what was it in response to? Huh. I don't know, guys, but with the with all these articles for what the police are controlling and what they're not controlling is very apparent. I'll be dropping that link into the comments if you'd like to get a good reading. I think it's pretty good. Now I'm gonna read this last thing for you all. This one Tumblr post that really helped inspire this, along with the fact of the timing of it all. Let me see if I can pull it up here in a moment. I actually just closed it while I was trying to find some good stuff. So this was on a Tumblr blog, and I think it's really important to think about as a ending point. By beachdeath.tumblr.com. I'll put that link right there. We're going to get into that right now. So, I worry that the way we talk about Stonewall decontextualizes the event itself. That saying, the first Pride was a riot, implicitly disconnects the raid on Stonewall from the fact that similar raids on gay bars have been happening for decades prior, and that LGBT activists had been actively resisting police violence all the while, at the risk of their lives and livelihoods and reputations. Police oppression of gay people did not begin in 1969, and gay resistance to police oppression did not begin with the Stonewall riots. That's not to minimize the extreme importance of Stonewall, of course, or the indelible contributions to our history and safety that were made by activists like Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson and Miss Major Griffin Gracie and Storm Delaverie. They were standing on the shoulders of decades and decades of leaders and activists who had come before them, who had fought and died and endured total brutality at the hands of homophobic police. Gay bars, as much as they were allowed to exist in the decades prior to Stonewall, were persistently targeted by undercover police officers and by violent raids. In Los Angeles, from the mid-1940s onward, the LAPD employed out-of-work actors to pretend to be gay and infiltrate these spaces, solicit men for sex, and then book them on charges of public indecency. The police department would give these officers quotas to meet on a weekly basis. Round up and jail a certain number of homosexuals, or else. Frequently, they would arrest men simply for appearing gay, or having the bad luck to walk through a park or use a bathroom known as a gay cruising spot. This policy was a cash cow like none other, because these men would always plead guilty, would always agree to pay hefty fines in order to settle the matter and keep it quiet and avoid having their reputations ruined. And the police would stop at nothing to bully people into pleading guilty. It was commonplace for police to handcuff their charges, shove them into the backseat of their cruisers, and then drive them in circle for hours, looping to the outskirts and back, intimidating and harassing them all the way. By the time they finally pulled up at the police station and booked their charges, they would be so shaken by the abuse they'd just experienced that they'd plead guilty without a second thought, cough up whatever money they could spare in order to go free. In less extreme cases, police officers would simply verbally abuse the men they'd arrested, but just as often, the officers would physically beat, sexually abuse, or rape these men. Oftentimes, the sexual abuse and rape would be part of the arrest itself. An officer would solicit sex from a man, the man would turn him down, and the officer would force him into sex anyway, and then report that the man had initiated it. Like, this was daily effing life for LGBT people for decades before Stonewall. And fledgling gay activists fought it with everything they had, early. In 1952, the Los Angeles Mattachine Society established the Citizens Committee to outlaw police entrapment after one of their founders, Dale Jennings, was stalked home by an officer, sexually harassed in his own bedroom, and then booked for public indecency. Rather than simply plead guilty, Jennings chose to contest these charges and take them to trial. A totally unprecedented move, with the aid of socialist lawyers George Shibley, and the jury voted 11-1 for acquittal, and he walked free. In 1952, 17 years before Stonewall. But this shiz kept happening everywhere for decades. New York City didn't end its policy of police entrapment of LGBT citizens until the mid-1970s. And all the while, there was organized resistance. All the while, organizations like the Mattachine Society and Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries fought back. It's super, super convenient for heterosexual society to claim that there was just one inciting incident, and one moment of spontaneous, courageous resistance that sparked the gay rights movement as we know it today. But we can't fall into that trap. There were decades of brutal, violent police oppression, and there were decades of structured, well-organized resistance to the oppression. For a long time, the gay struggle against police violence was the only fight there was. In the late 1940s, at the dawn of formal organization, nobody was agitating for their right to live openly as gay or avoid employment discrimination or get married or adopt children. The movement emerged in opposition to the systemized detainment and torture and rape of gay people by police, and that is why LGBT people don't owe the police anything, and why any police department with the audacity to demand time and space in Pride Parade needs to be met with loud, unequivocal resistance. Not because of one raid or one riot, but because of decades and decades of unapologetic brutality. So I just figured that I had to share that with you. I thought it was important. And last month I asked you, think about what you want to say, say it, for hashtag finding words. Do you think police should or should not be at Pride interacting with the queer LGBT community? Share, discuss, no matter how clumsy your wording is. If you end up being wrong about something, be open to criticism later, because what you say may or may not be addressed in the next program. This is that program. You folks said, no, I feel the majority of our queer community are oppressed and silenced. Pride is raw. It's true expression of self. It's powerful. There's no place for the police who are agents of oppression. Especially when you learn about where the movement started from and the long history of queer family dealings with the police. They're not there to protect queer family. They're there to protect bigotry. Oh, you're goddamn right, Kat McHugh. You're goddamn right. Katie Cumberbatch says, not in Columbus, Ohio. Or at least that's the assumed abbreviation there. They arrested some peaceful protesters at our Pride Parade last summer. The protesters were part of the LGBT community and people of color and were protesting the Castile BS. Columbus just hired back the cop that was kicking the guy while he was on the ground as well. It's hard to want Columbus cops anywhere near anyone. Watch your shiz, Columbus. Yeah, exactly. So, that's our show for today. I appreciate you guys listening to this program. And let's see. Once again, if you missed the earlier part of the interview with Deshaun Harrison, you can skip back to the beginning of this video or check out his stuff at DeshaunHarrison.com, his writing. Highly recommend looking at his stuff. and check that out. So, did you find yourself today while finding me? Feel free to send a message. You can contact us at 701-566-0917, at Nemo Potatoes on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Contact me through my contact tab on kppfm.com/finding-me and hit the contact tab. Like I said, email me at nemo@kppfm.com. So now let's see. And finally, in case you were not aware, you can now support me on Patreon. You can get sneak peeks to art and program building. Patreon.com/anemonefish. That is A-N-E-M-O-N-E fish. And you could also just, you know, buy me a coffee if you just want to fuel my coffee addiction. It's just $3 each, you know. Just keeps this project going. And you can, let's see, follow us on Facebook at 88.1 FM Fargo-Moorhead, the People's Press Project, and Mexi-Can. Donations to Fargo-Moorhead's newest low-power commercial-free radio station can be made at our website on kppfm.com/donate and check out our underwriting opportunities at kppfm.com/underwriting-opportunities on how you can support the first queer radio program in the Red River Valley. Thank you for tuning in. See you next month on the first Wednesday on Finding Me.